Hi, I'm Dave Reinersman, and welcome to The Marvels of Science, a podcast about the science and tech of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. All your favorite heroes and villains, from Odin and Nick Fury to Ulysses Klaue and Bucky Barnes. Speaking of the Winter Soldier, today's topic is prosthetics. How do they work? What are the challenges? And is Bucky's arm in any way realistic? Here with me to discuss all that and more are our two science experts today, Jutera Conway and Tony Gutierrez. Jutera is a prosthetics and orthotics resident at Baylor College of Medicine, who wrote her entrance essay on the depiction of prosthetics in fiction. Perfect. Welcome to the podcast, Jutera.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Tony is a prosthetist who's been practicing for 10 years, and I've been practicing saying that for a week, building new limbs and fitting advanced prosthetics in his clinic. Thanks for coming on, Tony.
Hey, thanks for having me again. Don't worry, imagine what it's like trying to tell your parents when you grow up that you want to be a prosthetist.
That's a very carefully enunciated conversation. And because we don't have an official color commentator this episode, I'm going to rely on our science experts to pull double duty. And God help us, I'm going to try to be funny. Before we get into anything, there's a vocabulary thing I want to try to figure out. Because in some places, I see the word prosthetic being used to describe not only the field, but like the actual devices, the actual prosthetic limbs and things. And other times, I see people very carefully using the word prosthesis. So who wants to weigh in on how much that matters?
I might take that one because it's an easy one. I'm so glad you asked that question, because I think that is a very common misconception. People often see a prosthesis or a prosthetic limb and say, oh, that guy has a prosthetic. And technically, that's not really how you should say it. Prosthetic is an adjective. So you can say a prosthetic limb, or prosthetic can describe the field, as in I'm in prosthetics. But if you want to talk about the actual device, it's a prosthesis, upper limb prosthesis or lower limb prosthesis. But prosthetic arm or prosthetic leg are also kind of acceptable.
Okay, good. First, we'll be all about our current understanding of prosthetics. We'll talk about how they work, the different types, the challenges their users face, and more. And don't worry, we'll fit in plenty of nerdy Marvel talk too. But we'll finish up with the future of prosthetics. What will future prostheses look like? What are the next steps? And what's stopping us from having lasers in our arms, like Ulysses Klaue?
Who?
Ulysses Klaue.
But first and foremost, let's talk movies. In 1945, Captain America's childhood friend and fellow soldier Bucky Barnes fell off a train and then down a mountain, which seems like overkill. Fortunately, he'd been experimented on by the evil organization Hydra, so he survived the fall, though he lost his left arm in the process. The bad guys, who had very good prostheses for the 1940s, gave him a new arm, brainwashed him, and sent him out into the world to do bad guy things.
Most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. The ones that do call him the Winter Soldier.
Eventually, 70-odd years later, he met up with his old pal Steve Rogers, Captain America, and became a good guy again. And then a bad guy again, very briefly, but then a good guy again.
I'm so confused.
These are confusing times.
And I do actually want to get a neuroscientist or psychologist to come on the show at some point to talk about brainwashing and hypnosis and those things. If you are one of those, email me at dreinersman@gmail.com. But first, let's get a definition. Jutera, what defines a prosthesis? I understand there's also a difference between prosthetics and orthotics.
Yes, I think the definition that people go to, which is not always technically correct, is replacing a limb. The only reason I'm hesitant about that is because we really cannot replace the functionality of the human body. Right now, we're just not there yet. So one of my professors described it as we're mimicking the function of a limb. And so I like that definition pretty well. I would say a prosthesis is anything that mimics the function of a limb.
Okay.
And then an orthosis is bracing a limb that is already there. So what I do a lot, since I work with kids right now, kids often don't have traumatic amputations, but what we do a lot with kids is the bracing of what they have. So for example, a shoe insert that just goes into your shoe and helps support the arch of your foot, or all the way up to like a brace that goes from your foot to your knee, up almost to your hip or past your hip, that helps you walk and realign your gait. So that's kind of the difference between orthoses and prostheses. Prostheses mimicking the function of a missing body part, and orthoses bracing and supporting the body part that's already there.
Gotcha. So we can compare then Bucky Barnes with his prosthetic arm to James Rhodes. Actually, they're both named James. James Buchanan Barnes and James Rhodey Rhodes with his orthoses on his legs after his accident in Civil War. Actually, careful viewers could notice that in the show, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, he has a cameo in the first episode, and they have very advanced orthotics in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, apparently, because there's just a few little lights along his legs that are covered in pants.
I don't know if Captain James Rhodes' device would actually be considered an orthosis. It's more of an exoskeletal device, which is a whole other can of worms to get into, because that's really a device that is applied over the body that can enhance function. Orthosis is only meant to support function or support loss function, where the exoskeletal is really meant to enhance it.
Okay. So like a factory worker, let's say, or a warehouse worker who's wearing a large exoskeleton helps them lift things that heavier than they normally would be able to.
Or lift the same amount without fatiguing for a longer time.
Oh, okay. And Tony, does a prosthesis have to be usable, functional, or can it just be aesthetic? Like, is a replacement eye, where does that fall into it? Does that fall into any of these categories?
Yes, we don't do those at all. I can't even say very often. We're more trained to the appendages of the body. But a prosthesis can be non-functional. There's a lady I have in my clinic right now that she has missing a fingertip, and we're going to do a silicone restoration. So there's also cosmetic devices as well as more functional ones.
Okay, let's talk about historical prostheses. The only sort of historical thing I can think of in all this way is like a pirate's peg leg or a hook hand, but I'm assuming that's not a complete history. Do you know of any ancient prostheses?
At school, we have an example of an old transfemoral socket. So transfemoral just being an amputation that's through the femur, so an above knee socket. And basically all it is a log that was hollowed out to become the shape of the residual limb. And that's all they did, was they would chip some wood out, stick their leg back in, see if it was fitting okay, chip some more wood out. And that was kind of the archaic process of how sockets were made. That's as early as I know.
I've seen those too. I have not made any, but I have repaired some. I've had an old-time patient that was actually a prosthetist come in and tell me he wanted a wooden leg. And I said, well, I was in my residency, Jotaro. And I said, well, you're welcome to come back in the shop and make it with me, because I have no idea.
Do you guys actually have like a wood shop out back? This is maybe jumping ahead of the story a little bit, but where do you make these things? Are they all like, you know, in factories by large companies, or do you have a wood shop out back where you carve legs?
Kind of a combination of both. Like a prosthetic knee and a prosthetic foot, or a prosthetic hand and a prosthetic elbow. Those are made by some of our vendors or some of our, you know, our big companies that do the science and research behind this technology. What Jotaro and I specialize in is crafting the socket, or the part of the prosthesis that touches the patient's limb.
Okay.
That's really where our expertise and training comes in. We're experts in anatomy, we're experts in managing complex three-dimensional shapes, and we're experts in material sciences. So prostheses can be made of a combination of plastics, carbon fibers, acrylic epoxy resins. They can be 3D printed. We have a lot of materials that we can use to make a prosthesis that'll match someone's complex shape. And most times we have our own fabrication facility, whether it's in a small office or within a large production type fabrication facility. But we have all of our dedicated tools and processes to build these prosthetic limbs for patients just about every day.
And that was one of my favorite things about the field, was coming in my first day of volunteering. I saw, this kind of looks like almost like a doctor's office. You know, it's got some patient rooms, it's got a front office. And then I went into the back and I was like, there's a whole machine shop back here. Like, there's a lab, there's a bandsaw, there's, you know, some dust, there's these grinding machines, like, and that's what I love about it too, is that it's so hands-on, but it's also in the health profession. So it's a little bit of engineering and medicine and art and workshop kind of all thrown together. And it's the best field, I think, ever.
Yeah, Jotaro, I always say to my patients, to my fellow colleagues, that I'm, you know, a health professional in the front, and I'm working with you, your doctor, your therapist, to develop your treatment plan. But then I get to go in the back and be a big kid and play with my Legos all day.
So, yes.
I assume there are broad categories of prosthesis. You mentioned upper limb and lower limb, but are there categories based on like what they can do or how much they can replicate or mimic of that natural function?
There are. I'll take lower limb first because upper limb gets a little complicated. But with lower limb, basically, I like to break it up into amputation levels. So you have your partial foot, your below knee or transtibial amputation, your knee disarticulation, so right between the tibia and the femur.
Like the joint itself.
Yes,
where the joint itself. Like a bone hasn't been broken, but the joint is sort of separated out.
Exactly. And then you have your transfemoral or above knee amputations, and then your hip disarticulations. Those are kind of some broad categories. And then with each prosthesis, you might have like an everyday prosthesis, and most amputees, I would say, do if they're lower limb. But some higher activity amputees or younger patients might have a high activity prosthesis or like a running leg, for example, something with a little more kickback. And as far as upper limb, you can break it down into the amputation levels as well. But I think with upper limb, the important thing that I like to distinguish them by is the method of control. And I'm sure we're going to talk about this a lot with Bucky's arm. But I think of three main categories for upper limb. I think of passive, which don't do anything. So it might just be like a tumbling terminal device. I'm trying to think of what I would call it. It's like a mushroom, basically. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't move, but it sits on the end of someone's limb so they can like do a cartwheel or something.
Okay.
So that's a passive device. And then you have your body powered upper limb, which are basically use a harness and kind of a cable system so that when you, for example, like flex your shoulders or move your arm forward, it will open and close the hand or something like that. And that's all done through cables and kind of a harness, like a pulley system. And then you have your really fancy stuff, which is the myoelectric controlled upper limb prostheses. And these basically read kind of the signals that your muscles send. So it picks up those signals when your muscles contract in your residual limb, when you flex those muscles that are left. It reads those signals and then tells the hand to do what you want it to do. But Tony, feel free to add on to that.
So that's what you want your limb to do sometimes.
Yes.
That's the key parts of myoelectric. But yes, Jotaro, congratulations. You will most likely pass your board exam. That was a great textbook answer.
That's great news.
To expand a little bit, yeah, the passive devices we see can be, you know, used, like Jotaro said, for like a handstand or a cartwheel. Also, a lot of times we'll see upper extremity and sometimes lower extremity amputees want more of a passive device, which means not the most function in the world, but they want it to be very cosmetically appealing. So we can kind of go that route as well. And to go a little bit further in the lower extremity, you know, we can go from very basic wooden feet, which we still use regularly in practice for some of our lowest level amputees, lowest functioning, all the way up through feet that have ankles built into them or super springy carbon fiber feet. A lot of options and a lot of ways we can help people get back to their normal level of mobility that they want to.
Where are the, I'm not sure what they're called, those like springs that seem to like curve back, I've seen people running on.
So that really is the science or the foundation for all modern prosthetic feet. That J shape you see, that spring you see in those amputee athletes, sometimes in the Paralympics that are going on right now, is the like the parent model of the first carbon fiber foot was a tall J shape spring. And 90% of current prosthetic feet are built on the concept of that J shape. Now, what we'll do sometimes is we can have shorter J shapes that are more sturdy, stable feet, but still provide that energy return. Or we can have really tall J shapes that are super lightweight, super springy, provide a ton of energy return, but your lower functioning or, you know, maybe like your grandparent style amputee might not want that much pop in their step. It's just going to throw them off balance.
Talking about, I'm not sure what to call it here, the seam, I'm guessing it's more complicated, Tony, than screw it on, sew up the edges, and put some tile caulking around the seams. How's a prosthesis get fitted onto a person?
So yeah, that is a complicated question, especially as you start to think with the upper extremity and stuff like Bucky Barnes's arm. But in general, I would say most cases, and I'm talking about lower extremity amputations, which is about 80% of what we work with on a regular basis, we apply a silicone gel liner over their limb. And then that silicone gel liner can either have like a pin or a screw in the bottom of it to attach to a lock, or there can be suction rings on it that'll actually create like a suction cup effect into the prosthesis and their limb. Or there's an outer sleeve that kind of goes up and over the next proximal joint to hold it on.
Gotcha. So I think what I've thought of in the past is something that's physically attached to their body. A little, I suppose, what we see, like what Bucky has, but that's, I think we'll talk about more about him in the future section of the episode. But is that a misconception or is that a future plan?
Yes and yes.
Okay. Great.
There is a type of prosthesis attachment called osseointegration. It's been around for about 20 years, starting in Sweden and Australia, and it's just made its way to the United States in the past 5 years. But essentially what they do for people that they deem their residual limb or their soft tissue, their skin and their muscle just can't tolerate a prosthetic limb for whatever reason, they can become a candidate to have a post inserted in the bottom of their primary bone in the leg. So below the knee would be the tibia or the shin bone. Above the knee would be the femur or the thigh bone. And that post is cemented into the bone. You do have a super thin layer of skin around that, but you essentially have an open wound on your limb for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It has a high infection rate that is getting more and more under control. But yeah, I've seen them in practice. I haven't seen them in my clinic yet. I've seen them at conferences and gone to a couple of education sessions on it. But that is a very interesting concept. They're not seeing things like fractures or breaks with it, which is great. They're seeing infections, but they're getting under control and they're improving it. And we're seeing it in VA patients right now, as well as the FDA has approved it for certain cases here.
I recall seeing some show 5 or 10 years ago talking about a big breakthrough will be when we can fuse skin to artificial substances. So there isn't that open wound anymore. So it's some polymer that we're able to make a prosthesis out of and then actually fuse it to human cells. But they said that will be a game changer in the field, but it was sort of a pipe dream. Seems like that's still a long way off.
I often think back to when I was at Jotera's point in my career on how advanced I thought the field of prosthetics was at that point. And then here, just a short 10 years later, my job and what I do on a daily basis is so much different than what I did back then that I can't wait to see what the next 10, 15, 20 years have in store for me as well.
How much does it change the process when the patient is still growing? Okay, that's a weird way to say that. How much does it change the process when it's a child who's getting a prosthesis, knowing that it's going to be, you know, obviously changing later on as the child grows? Does it change the process overall? I guess it's a question for Tony, probably.
No, I'll defer to Deshara. She's in the middle of a pediatric rotation right now, so she's the best to answer this.
Oh, all right.
With kids, we do have the problem of the bones want to keep growing. So often what they'll do for kids is instead of a through bone amputation where they cut the actual bone, they'll do a joint disarticulation. And this is the surgeons deciding this. Often prosthetists don't have a whole lot of say in what kind of surgery happens. But with kids, it's much better to do a surgery that's a disarticulation so that we have the end of the bone. And the bone might still grow, but it won't be growing like if you cut through a bone, the bone grows to a point and then keeps growing like at a point, trying to find the end of itself, but it won't because it's not there. So that can become a problem for kids, which is why most often for pediatrics, you see disarticulations instead of through bone amputations.
I've also learned two words I really don't like. Disarticulation. Every time somebody says that, that gives me a little like, yeah. And osteointegration. First time you said that, that was a, I can't.
Walk it off.
Okay. So about the future of prosthetics, Jotera, what is the holy grail in the field? Like sort of dream prosthesis and how would it differ from what people are using now?
The dream prosthesis. Two of the coolest things I think that are going to be more common in the future are osseointegration, like Tony mentioned. It just gives the patient better feedback because when they step on the ground with an osseointegrated prosthesis, they feel that shock go right up through the prosthesis into their bone. And so this gives them a lot more control and a lot more circular feedback as to what their prosthetic limb is actually contacting. So I think that is super cool. And the other thing that I am really looking forward to is TMR. It stands for Targeted Muscle Reinnervation.
Big English!
And that is basically where whenever you amputate a limb, you have these nerve endings that don't have a job anymore. These nerves that used to go to the hand that don't have anywhere to go anymore. So what they've done is they've found a way to split up that nerve and implant it into the muscles that are remaining in the residual limb. And that is super cool because it allows for more specific muscle movements to be made, kind of gives those nerves a job, assigns them to a muscle. And so they can do things, they can make your residual muscles move in cool ways and very specific patterns. And that allows for a lot of better options as far as myoelectric control.
In The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, we get, I think, was our first look at Bucky's shoulder without his arm attached. The Wakandans who built him this arm apparently put in a little fail-safe, and he runs into some Wakandans in a less than friendly way. And Oye does a few pressure point looking moves on his shoulder and his arm just falls off. And we see that the socket, his shoulder, is actually also metal. There's a permanent metal structure attached to his shoulder with sort of a ball joint sticking out of it. And then he picks up his arm after the fight is over, reattaches it, spins it around, and kind of cranks his shoulder like he's working out a stiff limb. Is there anything in that that we can point to as maybe realistic?
Yeah. As we go through this, I'm going to keep referring back to the most important part of a prosthesis as the socket. You know, the way things are held on to the body directly relates to control. Now, that ball joint and socket, I guess we don't have metal attachments to the limbs. That would make our job pretty hard. So those silicone interfaces really have eased things for us. But that ball joint that kind of clicks in can kind of be equivalent to what we call as like a pin locking liner, which there's a silicone or there's something on the tissue of the limb that's holding there. And then there's a physical attachment between that silicone piece as well as the prosthesis. Now, the amount of control for that short of an amputation level, that's pretty impressive. So there is an analogy there. It's not perfect by any means, but there's an analogy.
All right. Tony, are your holy grails of prosthetics similar to Jotaro's?
Not at all.
Oh, yeah?
And this is probably the difference between, you know, a clinician that's been practicing for 10 years and seeing the daily struggles of working with patients every day to someone in Jotaro's position who's just starting her clinical career. My holy grail of prosthesis is a prosthetic socket that doesn't need to be changed. It can adjust with the patient. You know, we're eating, breathing, living human things. We grow a little bit every day. We shrink a little bit every day. That's when you hop on the scale, you know, every day or so every couple of days, it's always a different number. And that's all based on our diet, what we're doing on a daily basis. So an amputee's limb is the same way. And those daily minute fluctuations in volume can wreak havoc on people. So if we can get to a point where we have a socket that's comfortable, adjustable, and accommodative to a patient's limb all day, then we can focus on a lot of other things like enhancing their mobility. And then the next holy grail of mine is lighter, faster, and stronger. Anything I can do to make a prosthesis as light as I can, as fast or as dynamic as I can, and as strong as I can for the patient is always going to improve outcomes.
That sounds good. Can I change my answer?
I think when I think of the most advanced prostheses, one that looks like Ulysses Claws comes to mind. He's the guy in Black Panther who had his arm chopped off back in Avengers Age of Ultron.
Ooh, I'm sure that's going to be okay.
Andy Serkis plays him. His arm is more or less indistinguishable from a biological one, at least until it opens up and turns into a laser cannon. We'll hold off on that advancement for now. But is that something that people in the field are looking toward as like a 5 or 6 steps down the road? Okay, once we, you know, get these better sockets, and then once we get them to have a really great level of feedback, maybe then we'll talk about trying to make them look as similar as we can to a biological limb? Or is that sort of like, yeah, sounds nice, but like, let's talk about it, you know, 2 generations from now? Where's that in the conversation?
I think it's the exact opposite.
Oh, yeah?
I think we're really good at mimicking. We can do a really good job with silicone, and we have artists come in that can really paint to detail and match someone's limbs side by side. Say they're missing their left arm, they'll paint a mirror image of their right arm onto the silicone and apply it over their prosthesis. We could do that quite well.
Wow.
Functions opposite. I think we're very elementary in our function. Even all the advancements that we have, we're still pretty elementary in our function.
With Bucky Barnes, we also see that he has very fine control. I mean, this is getting to what you were talking about, Tony, with where we're still pretty elementary in our function mimicry. But he seems to have very fine control over his fingers, even though his amputation is presumably at the shoulder. Are we anywhere close to that sort of fine manipulation?
I think we are. Yeah, we have some fine manipulation. I guess we have prosthetic hands that have 15, 20 different grasps available. So anywhere from a whole hand grasp to just pinching your 2 index fingers together to pinching your index thumb and middle finger together, you know, kind of just moving your thumb up and down and catching the side of your hand. We have a lot of hands that can do that. Now that fine of control, no, really still at the hand op level, we still have an open signal and a closed signal. Mm. So whatever muscles we're utilizing, we're going to tell that prosthesis in a chain. Say for Bucky's instance, it would be flex the shoulder, extend the shoulder, flex the elbow, extend the elbow, turn the wrist up, turn the wrist down, open the hand, close the hand. I like to think of it as if you're telling your body to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You say, okay, go get a plate. Go get the bread. Open the bread. Go get the peanut butter. Go get the jelly. Go get the knife. Now start spreading. It's a step-by-step process that we have to reteach our amputee patients, which is a very mentally frustrating, mentally confusing process, as opposed to like what Bucky's doing in the movie is just, hey, go and get it, right?
Right.
You just tell your arm, hey, go and get it.
One of the reasons I think we see Bucky able to do so many things that mimic a biological limb is because the actor has a biological limb underneath this sleeve that looks like metal.
Why didn't you use the metal arm?
Well, I don't always think of it immediately. I'm right-handed.
Jotaro, what do you... You wrote your entrance essay into to grad school on prostheses in fiction. What do we think about the representation of somebody who's using a prosthesis but seems to have no difficulties with it whatsoever? I'm thinking of seeing a prosthetic limb in fiction combined with what Tony's talking about with the experience of his patients who are struggling with them every day. The only struggle we ever see Bucky have is one time the Wakandans make it fall off and then he puts it back on again 15 seconds later.
No, that's a really fair point because I have a love-hate relationship with prostheses in fiction. I think on one hand, science fiction inspires research and development. And that, I think, is kind of what got me into the field. Seeing Luke Skywalker's prosthetic hand in episode 5, that was the moment where I was like, that is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I think it's cool because I think we're getting there. I think we're on our way to what we do see in fiction, which is cool and fun to see that and think, oh, well, maybe I could make something like that. And then let that kind of drive the research and development that we do. I think just creative imagination is one of the best foundations for scientific advancement. And then on the downside, you have kind of that inaccurate representation. This isn't really what prostheses are like in real life. This isn't really the kind of aesthetics that doesn't always look that cool. It does not always function the way it looks like it functions. You don't get like sensory feedback. Little things like that where especially it's heartbreaking and difficult when you have a patient who comes in and says, who's a new amputee, who's never had a prosthesis before. And they say, oh, well, I want something like I saw in this YouTube video or this movie or this show. And you kind of have to break it to them and say, well, we need to set some expectations of what is really out there and what is going to work best for you. And so that really is, can be a difficult conversation to have.
I like the research and development that comes out of it, but science fiction and pop culture have kind of made prostheses sexy for patients. Like, you know, they
also true.
Maybe when I was at Jotaro's point, most of the prostheses I made had some kind of cosmetic finishing on them to make it look as natural as possible. Hide it. You don't want people to know. But over the last 10 years, really, as this Marvel universe has developed, I've had more and more patients, not just young patients or not just people that like Harley Davidson or, you know, I've had grandmas and grandpas want something cool on their prosthesis. Like, hey, can you put my dog on it? A picture of my dog. Or, hey, can you make this look like a chrome finish for me?
You have a metal arm? That is awesome.
Stuff like that. There's a whole thing called in the amputee and prosthetics community, especially during April, which is Limb Loss Awareness Month this past month. I guess it's on social media. It's like a hashtag show your metal. So it's people showing off their prosthetic limb, showing those metal pipes, showing the metal knee joints, showing what it is because they're proud to have it now.
Yeah, I love that.
I really like that. My last question for the both of you, what kind of technological advancements, and feel free not to be constrained by reality here, this is a podcast about comic book science, what kind of advancements would you need to voluntarily have one of your limbs replaced with a prosthetic one?
I want to be really hesitant about this because really what we have right now, nothing can quite perfectly replicate the function of a limb. So that being said, I think, first of all, if it's upper limb, it needs to be lightweight. You don't just want a dead weight hanging off the end of your arm. So I need smaller batteries. I need lighter motors. And then I need a specific, very accurate and intuitive way to control that prosthesis. And then I also want sensory feedback so that when a pin pricks my palm, I know it and I react to it. And I want it to look like an arm. So those are my requirements. There's a lot of them. But yeah, nothing's quite like the human body.
Tony, what would your list of requirements be?
Function. I would outweigh function, increase function by any means. But my number one would be everyone has their intact hands in front of them. They likely have a pen in front of them, right? Or a microphone or your cell phone. Mm-hmm. Reach out and try and put your hand over the entire object right in front of your face. Now try and pick it up. But imagine you can't feel anything. Mm. Sensation would be the key to me, especially in any kind of upper limb amputation. If you could feel that object in front of you, that would be the biggest game changer for us as prosthetists. We have these super awesome, super advanced prosthetic hands that all five fingers can move. There's 20 grip patterns. But if you put that hand in front of something like a penny or something, that patient can't see through that hand to pick it up. So still, even our most advanced upper limb users who love this myoelectric technology, for the most fine motor control skills, they'll all kind of point towards the need of a mechanical hook that is just two little pinch points that you can see around them and manipulate fine objects. So sensation would be the biggest for me if I was to voluntarily have this done.
Next up, we have a segment in the show called Technically. First up is Jotara Conway. Tony and I are going to keep quiet for 2 or 3 minutes as Jotara gives us some nuance or details on anything related even tangentially to the topic. Jotara, you have the floor.
Technically. And I did pretend like I was pushing on my glasses there.
Thank you.
There is no such thing as a brain-controlled prosthesis. And I think you get a lot of this online. It's probably just clickbait. So there is some research in that area, but there's nothing that's clinically available for upper limb or lower limb for that matter, where you can just think, oh, I want to close my hand and it automatically happens. And what we do have, which we've talked about a little bit, is myoelectric control. And what this is it picks up signals from your remaining or residual muscles. So there are usually electrodes implanted in the socket, which are basically little metal sensors that are in contact with the skin on the residual limb. And when the patient flexes the muscles in their residuum, the electrodes will pick up those electrical signals that are fired, and then the signal is sent to the prosthetic hand to tell it to open or close. Now, if you want to get really fancy, there are two main types of myoelectric control. The first is direct control. And what this does is it uses two pairs of electrodes. So it only allows you to be in one mode at a time. So for example, if you have an amputation just above your wrist, you can flex the muscles on the top of your forearm, and that will tell the prosthetic hand to close. And then you can flex the muscles on the back of your forearm, and that will tell it to open. But since you only have the two electrode pairs, all you can do is open, close, open, close, open, close, unless you have a mode switch. So what a mode switch is some kind of special motion, like a contract both your front and back muscles at the same time, or do a double contraction really fast. And that will tell the hand, oh, we're not going to open, close anymore. We're going to switch modes into wrist up, wrist down. And then you can do up, down, up, down, up, down until you tell it to switch back. So that's the first kind of myoelectric control. The second kind, which is what my research is in, which is very exciting, is pattern recognition control. And this uses as many as 8 pairs of electrodes, and it's very sensitive. It can pick up on the small differences in muscle activation. It's very nuanced. So the advantage of this is that you don't have to switch between mode A and mode B. The system can tell the difference between a command to open and a command to twist your palm up or palm down. So it allows for a variety of movements at any given time without switching between modes. So that's kind of a cool new development too, is instead of just direct control where you get two motions, you have pattern recognition, which allows a variety of motions. So that's what my research is on.
Sounds fascinating.
It's very fascinating.
And Tony?
Technically, I've been trying to think of the best way to say it. I'm going to kind of piggyback off some of what Jotara has and add some of my own to it, because the pattern recognition is something that's been around for the past 3 or 4 years, and it's getting more and more developed every year. And that really is a big game changer for all of our upper extremity amputees. And that's what is the first step of what we're doing in prosthetics that's going to make what Bucky can do somewhat possible. The fact that we can utilize our remaining musculature, it's usually coupled with the TMR, targeted muscle reinnervation surgery, that Jotara mentioned earlier. We can really use those innate nerve signals that are still coming down from the brainstem when you're telling your body to do something to really start to control those muscles. The biggest limitation in all this is, you know, how can we represent the whole body function? You know, in most of what we do in prosthetics with our cases that most people could see, we can offer a shoulder that stays locked in place, no motion, especially for Bucky's level of amputation, an elbow that flexes and extends, and a hand that opens and closes, and a wrist that'll turn up and turn down. In some of the more advanced, there's a prosthetic arm called a Mobius Bionic, or a Luke arm. It's by Deca Research. and it's a amputation through the shoulder level that offers a powered shoulder, elbow, wrist, hand joint that also offers, I guess, humeral rotation. So your elbow can kind of twist in and out away from your body. Your forearm can twist. Your hand can open and close. Elbow can open and close. Shoulder can go up forward towards your face, out towards the side, behind you. So we finally have 5 powered joints that we can put into a prosthesis. Now the control problem is a big one. How are we going to control these 5 joints? Pattern recognition is helping us get there. What the most advanced control mechanism right now for a prosthesis that complex is actually we'll put sensors in the shoes that will control the prosthesis. So the patient can't necessarily use their arm while they're walking or running like Bucky could, or jumping through the air and grabbing a helicopter and throwing it to the ground, but they can stop and they can, you know, reach down, grab some groceries off the floor and put them up on a shelf. So we're getting there in our function. Really excited to see what great things Joterra is going to bring to the field here in the next 10 years and how cool our prosthetic limbs are going to get and patients we get to work with will be.
Awesome. Thanks so much. I want to be clear as always that I love these movies. Scientific accuracy is not a necessary component for good storytelling. In fact, sometimes it gets in the way. I want to thank my guests, Joterra Conway and Tony Gutierrez, for being on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and cross your fingers there's an episode 19. Thanks once again to my guests, Tony Gutierrez and Joterra Conway. Their effortless and egoless enthusiasm for this team-up episode means a lot to me. I'm going to ask you a favor, share this episode with one friend you think would like it. And if you want to go a step further, I'll ask what every small podcast asks, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. If you want to go nuts, you can support the podcast directly at patreon.com/marvelsofscience. MCU audio clips were taken from Black Panther, Captain America the Winter Soldier, Captain America Civil War, The Avengers, Avengers Age of Ultron, Avengers Endgame, Guardians of the Galaxy, and The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and all used entirely without permission. The music is a song called On Tiptoe from Purple Planet Music. That song and more royalty-free music can be found at purple-planet.com. Check out more info about each episode and its guests, including upcoming episodes, at davereinersman.com/marvelsofscience, and find me on Twitter at marvelsoscience. Thanks for listening!